You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Alright, welcome back once again to another episode in the File and Claw audiobook archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, aka Imperial Washington, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920, written by Richard Franklin Pettigrew, the first United States, the first senator from the state of South Dakota. And it was published in 1922 by the Charles H. Kerr and Company of Chicago. And this book, I kind of ran across it by accident, but I feel it's pretty important because honestly it gives a very authoritative vision of a time period in America when the robber barons, the railroads, the trusts, the corporations, the banks, the combinations, were pretty much taking command and control of the United States government and manipulating it to their own benefit. And I think this is really the time period when they sewed it all up. Honestly. I mean, this is after this, it was game over, pretty much. And so, Pettigrew gives a great insight because he was right there in the middle of it. He was in the Senate. During all this time, he fought battles with these people in the Congress, and you can tell it really just stunned him. And I don't think it's surprising to say that he didn't make a lot of friends while he was a senator, and he didn't get super rich or wealthy. So anyways, let's continue on with the book here. As always, I will be attempting to keep the audiobook archive recordings down to about 1 hour in length wherever possible. Can't always do that, but I'll try. I'll be spelling any last names because I tend to butcher pronunciation and because, it's handy for further research on some of these shady characters who have been kind of passed over, glossed over, or kind of forgotten throughout all these years. And other than that, we're going to jump right into it now. This is Chapter 9, Plutocracy. Bit by bit, the evidence accumulated under my eyes until it constituted a mountain of irrefutable proof. The public domain seized and exploited by the interest and for their private profit, the concentration of power in the hands of the bankers, their manipulation of money for their own benefit, the tariff used as a favor granted by Congress for the few to plunder the many, the wanton and reckless creation of trusts and aggregations of capital, the vast strength of the railroads and other public utility monopolies, the ferocious indifference of those interests to the public welfare and to the well-being of the masses of the people. As I surveyed all this evidence, I could form only one possible conclusion, that the power over American public life, whether economic, social, or political, rested in the hands of the rich. So, again, going back, like I said, I mean, the last couple chapters, he's pretty much spent talking about his battles with the trusts and the banks and the railroads and all these different groups and money, the money masters and the tariff manipulators and all these people. And he's saying, yeah, pretty much over my time, I saw them take over. So there it is. Continuing now. It is said that in the past, in the days of the Roman Empire, when a wealthy Roman wished to build a villa, he purchased the right to tax and govern a conquered province in Asia and return to Rome to enjoy his fortune. But when an American millionaire wishes to build a villa or buy a title in Europe, he purchases a tariff privilege from the Congress of the United States, or corrupts a legislature or a city council and secures a franchise, and proceeds to rob his neighbors. I am of the opinion that the Roman way was the best. Plutocracy is a word that means rule by and for the rich. The United States is a country run by and for the rich. Therefore, it is a plutocracy. What more can you say about that? The rich few own the United States. The rich few who own it direct its public policy. For years, these facts have been apparent to the discerning. Today, even the short-sighted may see them quite plainly. Oh yeah, and that carries on definitely till today. I think most people could probably agree with his sentiments that he wrote back in 1922. Continuing. Read the following letter which Lincoln wrote to William P. Elkin on November 21st, 1864. Quote, I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. As a result of war, corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all the wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed. I feel at this moment more anxiety for the safety of my country than ever before, even in the midst of war. God grant that my suspicions may prove groundless. Unquote. It has been well said by the famous English writer and philanthropist, Mr. Stead, or is that Stead? I don't know. Spelled S-T-E-A-D. That the modern business world has adopted a new golden rule as follows. Quote, dollars and dimes, to be without money is the worst of crimes. To keep all you get and get all you can is the first and last and the whole duty of man. Unquote. And a little nursery rhyme for you. That this golden rule has been adopted by the so-called businessmen of the United States is evidenced by what has been accomplished in the distribution of the wealth produced by the great toiling masses of this country. Recently, it was announced that John D. Rockefeller had finally succeeded in accumulating $1 billion, thus making him the richest man that ever lived. The American people know how he succeeded in accumulating this vast sum. He produced none of it. He secured all of it by exploiting the American people who had produced it. The most thrifty of the American people do well if they succeed in saving $300 a year, above all their expenses. And they must be busy every day in the year in order to do that. To accumulate $1 billion at the rate of $300 a year, a dollar a day for 300 working days, a man would have to live and labor for 3,333,333 years. He would have to be older than Methuselah. He would have to start when the world was hot, no matter where he ended up. But if he was cunning, unscrupulous, and religious, and followed Rockefeller's method of robbing his fellow men, he could get the $1 billion prize in 50 years. $1 billion is equivalent to the earnings of 100,000 men for 20 years, providing they earn $500 apiece each year, and during all that time leaving nothing out for sickness, death, or accident. The fact that Rockefeller could appropriate the earnings of his fellow men, and the fact that he did do it, is what has caused the social and economic protest against the existing system and the cry for justice. This great and powerful force, the accumulated wealth of the United States, has taken over all the functions of government, Congress, the issue of money, and banking, and the army and navy, in order to have a band of mercenaries to do their bidding and protect their stolen property. Immediately after the announcement that Rockefeller was worth $1 billion, Armour and Swift, and those last names, Armour, A-R-M-O-U-R, and Swift is S-W-I-F-T, announced a dividend upon their capital stock of 33 1/3%, and each of these concerns increased their capital stock from 20 millions to 100 millions. It is safe to say that neither of these concerns had any capital stock for which they had paid a dollar. Their capital stock represented what they had stolen from the people of this country. Their working capital is represented by bonds. The 80 million of stock which they have since added is also nothing but water, and is issued so as to make the annual dividends appear smaller. The exploited people will object less to paying 6 or 7% on 100 millions than to paying 33 1/3% on 20 millions. It looks better in print. How do Armour and Swift make their money? They are the great packers. Well, I mean, he's talking about this is meat packing and stuff. So, continuing. They are in collusion. They fix the prices they pay the farmer for his hogs and cattle, and they fix the prices they will charge the consumer for their product. They are simply robbing the producer and the consumer, and their robbery is represented in their great wealth, which they did not produce, but which they took from the people under the guise of law. When the bill to take the census of 1890 was pending before Congress, I secured an amendment requiring the enumerators to ascertain the distribution of wealth through an inquiry into farms, homes, and mortgages. Using the so he was responsible for the amendment that took a tally of people's earnings in 1890 with the census. Alright, continuing on. Using the figures thus secured by the enumerators of the census of 1890, on June 10, 1918, I delivered a speech in the Senate of the United States on the subject of the distribution of wealth in the United States, and from the census of 1890, I showed that 52% of the people of the United States owned $95 worth of property per capita, or $95 each of second-hand clothing and second-hand furniture, and that 4,000 families own 12 billions of the wealth, And that's 6,640,000 families, or 52% of the population, own 3 billions of the wealth, or just 5% of the total. Wow. That's pretty crazy. The facts, as ascertained by the census takers in 1890, appear summarized in the following table. And there's a whole page worth of tables here that I will not be able to cover in the audiobook podcast. Go on to the website, which is located at www.fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. Or if you cannot find the site there, as it has moved a few times, go on to Twitter and find my profile on there. The handle is at fileandclaw322. In the profile, there will always be a link to the latest incarnation of the website. So go on there and take a look at the post for this podcast, this particular one. And this will be located under figure number one. I will put these online for you. All right, continuing on with the book here. It will be seen from these tables, which are compiled from the census report of 1890, that 52% of the people, or 2% more than half of them, owned but 5% of the accumulated wealth of the United States. The report of the Industrial Commission, which thoroughly investigated the distribution of wealth in the United States, discloses the fact that, after 26 years, covering half of the period in which Rockefeller and Armour and Swift and the other exploiters of the people have accumulated their vast fortunes, the number of people who participated in the 5% of the wealth of the United States has increased from 52% of our total population to 65%. I have prepared a diagram illustrating the conclusions reached by the experts of the Industrial Commission, which pictures these stupendous inequalities that have arisen in the United States during the past 26 years. And there's more charts here, so again, go on the website. This will be under figure number 2. I will post those up as well. I wish a careful examination of these tables. You will see that 65% of the people own 5% of the wealth, and that 2% of the population, the little black line at the top of the diagram, own 60% of the wealth. They did not produce the wealth. It was all produced by the 65% of the population who have nothing. They were able to do it because they owned the government and the courts and enacted the laws which made it possible. They have done it through manipulation, combination, and exploitation. They have done it through corporations. They have done it because they own the railroads and the banks and all the public utilities and use them all. All of these great important public service institutions in order to gather the products of everybody's toil into their own hands. In other words, they have stolen what others have produced. And I'm just going to take a break there because some people are definitely going to, I mean, as soon as they hear the word redistribution of wealth, they're like, oh my God, shut off your brain. We can't listen to this anymore. Because it's a communist or socialist or whatever. But honestly, I mean, if you just listen to what the guy's saying and you look at these charts, which will be provided, I mean, of course, you see why people were so stirred at the time. There's, it almost seems like, well, of course, I mean, there's such a disadvantage, and even more so today, I think, but people can tell there's something not right, and there's these people who seem to sit around, like, today, the obvious equation would be a CEO of a company, and he comes in for a couple years, and he does what? Usually, he runs the company into the ground, and then he gets a severance package with a huge pension, or, you know, one of these golden parachutes, they call it, and he's set for life. And so, at the time, it wasn't exactly the same back in the early 1900s, but there was definitely something similar going on, and people could tell, and that's why they were all riled up and going on about this. So I mean, again, you can tune it out because it doesn't jive with your ideology, but what we always say is that the truth follows no ideology. And these things existed, and I think most people can look at it and say, you know what, that's probably a problem, or problematic. It's not how we want the system to function. Whether you believe in capitalism, or socialism, or communism, or whatever, you can look at the system now and be like, you know what, that's wrong, and it's not how, if it is the system you want, you can at least agree that that's not how the system I want should operate. So something's wrong with it. It needs some tweaking or something. But anyways, let's not get too far afield in that and get back to the book here. These were the figures for 1916. Since that time, there have come the war and the panic, with their huge crop of millionaires and their further concentration of wealth and of economic power. But you may ask, why is it necessary to turn to the figures of the Industrial Commission? Why not use the census figures? The answer is very simple. Since the publication of the 1890 figures, the plutocrats have decided that the facts regarding wealth distribution shall not be permitted to get into the hands of the American people. When I entered the Senate, I believed that the question of the distribution of wealth was one of the most important ones before the American people, and one that was receiving no attention whatever. While I was in the House, I had made the personal acquaintance of Senator Jones of Arkansas, who was on the Committee on Indian Affairs in the Senate, and Senator Berry of Arkansas, who was on the Committee of Public Lands in the Senate. And those names are, well, Jones, I mean, come on, everybody knows how to spell that, J-O-N-E-S, and Senator Berry, his last name, B-E-R-R-Y. Continuing now. So that before the Senate convened in December 1889, when I took my seat in the Senate, I had talked with these two senators about securing legislation to ascertain the distribution of wealth in the United States. They had entered heartily into the plan, which we prepared a bill for that purpose, footnote here, which was introduced by Senator Berry as an amendment to the Census Bill of 1890. And there is a footnote, and at the bottom it says, it's a reading out of the bill, but we'll throw it in here, what the hell. The footnote says, the bill was worded as follows, quote, that a census of the population, wealth, and industry of the United States shall be taken as of the date of June 1st, 1890, Statutes of the U.S., page 761, March 1st, 1899. So there you go. There's the footnote. Now let's continue on with the book here. He was talking about him and Pettigrew and Jones and Berry. Senator Berry, who also introduced the amendment to the Census Bill of 1890. So he's talking about the process of getting this amendment in. This bill attracted little attention and was passed practically without opposition, but I had great difficulty in getting the persons in charge of taking the census to go thoroughly into the question. Finally, under the head of Farms, Homes, and Mortgages, an investigation was made by Holmes, and a report was issued, I think, about 1898. And that guy, his name is Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S. This report showed a remarkable economic condition in this country and disclosed the fact that 52% of our population had 5% of the wealth they had produced, and that 9% of our population had a majority of all the property in this country. I made a speech in the Senate upon this subject, going quite fully into the question, and in that speech I predicted that the number of people who had nothing would steadily increase under our system, and that the number of people who owned a majority of the wealth would steadily decrease. I consider the question so important that I secured a place on the Senate Census Committee to prepare the bill for taking the census of 1900. In the committee, I urged an amendment to the bill for taking the census, which should go fully into the question of the distribution of wealth in the country. But the committee refused to adopt my amendment or to take any notice of the question whatever. Incidentally, the committee was composed of lawyers, and a lawyer is trained to believe that it is the right of property in the hands of men who did not produce the property that is sacred, and not the rights of man. Or that society has any obligation whatever to those who toil. We borrowed this from England. We borrowed this from England, and it is so thoroughly inculcated into our whole system of educational and economic life that there is no question but that the lawyers honestly believe it to be true. After the census bill was reported to the Senate, I offered my amendment under these circumstances. And this from the Congressional Record, 56th Congress, First Session, January 11, 1900, Volume 331, page 779. And just as a side note, as always, we're going to go into congressional testimony, so it will appear in the form of the person who's speaking name and then their quote afterwards. All right? Here we go. Mr. Pettigrew, quote, I offer an amendment which I send to the desk, unquote. The President pro tempore, quote, the amendment of the senator from South Dakota will be stated, unquote. The Secretary, it is proposed to add as Section 3 the following lines. Section 3, that the director of the census is hereby required to collect statistics relating to the indebtedness of individuals and corporations, public or private, also in relation to the distribution of wealth among the people of the United States, also statistics as to the displacement of labor by machinery, and the increase of the power of production by machinery in proportion to the number of laborers employed during the last 30 years. And for this purpose, the director of the census may employ special agents, and such special agents shall receive such compensation as other special agents. Unquote. Mr. Pettigrew, Mr. President, this amendment is intended to secure the statistics with regard to the distribution of wealth. It does not require the enumerators to gather the statistics on this subject, and therefore will not delay the purpose of the law which we have passed. We make the Census Bureau, as I understand, a perpetual bureau of statistics and information, and to fail to gather the information referred to in my amendment, it seems to me, would be a very serious mistake. The question as to what becomes of what the toilers of the land produce, whether it goes to them or is taken away from them by special privileges and accumulated in the hands of a very few people, is a very important one and reaches ultimately the question of the preservation of free institutions. The other subject in my amendment is with regard to the displacement of labor by machinery and the increased power of production thereby. I desire this information for the reason that I believe man's power to produce, as the result of the adoption of machinery, has increased many times more than the increase of his wages, which should have occurred as a result of his increased powers of production. In other words, that the increased power of production is the result of machinery and has inured to the advantage of capital many times more than to the advantage of labor. That this has caused, in a large degree, the unequal distribution of wealth in this country. That the increased power of production as the result of machinery should go to the toiler in a much larger degree than to the capital employed. that the power to produce by machinery is a benefit to mankind if the increased power to produce goes to the toiler, because his power to consume is also increased, and thus the consumption and enjoyment of a greater measure of the luxuries and comforts of life must go to those who produce the wealth of the land. I therefore believe these two questions are exceedingly important, and I have asked that this information be collected by special agents rather than by the enumerators, so that it will not delay a single day or a single hour the securing of that information, which seems to be the prime object of the bill. I hope the additional section I have offered will be adopted without objection. Unquote. Woo, and that's a long quote. Continuing on now with the congressional record, this time from January 11, 1900. Mr. Tillman, quote, I will say for the information of the senator from Georgia that if it is not taken with the first census, it cannot be taken at all without an intolerable additional expense. It is for the Senate to determine whether it will enlarge the scope of the census. If we break down the barrier erected by the Census Committee, we simply, as we were notified by the Senator from Missouri, Mr. Cockrell, the other day, open up a flood of amendments concerning each special class of inquiry any Senator may wish to have included. Unquote. And that guy's name, the senator from Missouri, Cockrell, his name is C-O-C-K-R-E-L-L. Mr. Pettigrew, quote, my amendment provides for nothing of the kind. It simply provides that this Census Bureau of Statistics, which is perpetual, may by special agents, not by enumerators, investigate this all-important subject. I think the census would be of very little value without it. It is not personal to myself, nor a subject that I am particularly or personally interested in, even though he says he considers it very important, but that's just an aside, let me continue. But it is a great public question. The question of the distribution of wealth of this country is certainly a question of more importance than almost anything else that can be investigated. As the senator from Colorado, Mr. Teller, has said, we have almost day by day a very accurate estimate of the population. We have very many other statistics which are constantly being produced by the Statistical Bureau, but the question of the distribution of wealth of this country has never been adequately and fairly investigated. And it ought to be. And that's definitely true. I wonder why. I wonder why they don't investigate that. Continuing on. I do not propose to delay the taking of the census, and my amendment does not delay it at all. It simply provides an additional section for the doing of this additional work. If the schedules are all prepared and the work is disposed of, the enumerators can commence their operations, and therefore the department will have the time to get out additional schedules for the special agents to do the work, which I desire to have done. This work cannot commence until an appropriation is made. It is quite proper, then, that the amendment should be on this bill, because Section 8 is in the original law, which provides a large amount of extra work to be done after the main census has been taken through the enumerators. And if it was a proper time to provide Section 8 in the law when it passed last year, it is time now for my amendment to be placed on this bill. That is all I want. I do not care to discuss it further. Unquote. The reasons in favor of taking a wealth census seem to me conclusive. Nevertheless, the amendment met with, you guessed it, universal opposition, and it was rejected. When the census bill was pending to take the census of 1910, I wrote to Senator La Follette, his last name L-A-F-O-L-L-E-T-T-E, and urged him to secure an amendment with relation to the distribution of wealth in this country, but La Follette is a lawyer and he did nothing. I also sent him a statement of the facts in connection with the matter and a copy of my speech delivered in 1898 on this subject, but I was unable to accomplish anything as the Senate was still composed almost entirely of lawyers who had represented as attorneys before they entered the Senate, and who still continued to represent as attorneys after they entered the Senate, the great industrial, financial, transportation, and exploiting interests. While the census bill to provide for the census of 1920 was under consideration in both houses, I went to Washington and personally went to the committee of both houses and urged the importance of securing statistics with regard to the distribution of wealth in this country. But neither committee would entertain my proposed amendment or listen with patience to any argument. In reply to my analysis of the situation, the members of the committees insisted that it was not true. "Why," said they, quote, "look about you and see the prosperity everywhere. How can you say, then, that the wealth of the country is in the hands of the rich?" Unquote. "Well," I answered, quote, "if it is not true, and if the census of 1890, the Industrial Commission, and all of the rest of the authorities are wrong, the thing to do is to take another wealth census and disprove all of their false statements," unquote. Still, I could make no impression on the lawyers who made up both committees. The committees of Congress, having the censuses of 1910 and 1920 in charge, refused to include in the census bills a clause requiring the enumerators to ascertain the distribution of wealth, because they, as representatives of the plutocracy, did not desire the facts to be known. The bulk of the American people have little or no wealth. The economic power of the United States is concentrated in the hands of the few, and the few are determined to keep the many in ignorance as long as they possibly can. I have gone into some detail with regard to this matter of the wealth census, not so much because of its intrinsic importance, but because of its relation to other and similar issues. Again and again, on other questions, these same men who refuse to gather the evidence of wealth concentration have introduced and voted for the measures which were drawn up by the attorneys of the vested interests for the purpose of increasing wealth concentration. The economic power of the United States has been concentrated in the hands of a very few, and they are the government. They pass the laws that, in their judgment, will protect and defend the property upon which their power depends. They secure the appointment of judges who will interpret and who do interpret this legislation in the interest of the wealth-owning classes, control those who execute the laws from the presidents down. Indeed, for the most part, the presidents are lawyers, and either members of the plutocracy or else paid retainers of the plutocracy. They control all of the channels of public opinion, the press, the schools, the church. They control the labor unions through the control of their leaders and of the policy that the leaders pursue. Possessors of the land on which the farmer must work, of the mines and the machines with which the laborer must work in order to live, the plutocracy, a.k.a. the wealth class, in the United States is supreme over the affairs of public life. Today, this economic power is not ashamed to show its head and take its place as the master of the American government and as the overlord of the American people. They used to talk about the... Wait a second. Listen to this line. They used to talk about the invisible government when I entered the Senate in 1890, but it is invisible no longer. So, wow, they had shadow government all the way back in 1890. There were murmurs in the halls of Congress. That's what Pettigrew's telling you. It's not some age-old thing, man. This has been going on for a long time. The real government is not in Washington. Its attorneys are there, but its responsible directors are in New York and in the other great centers of commerce and industry. Wealth means power in an industrial civilization, and the few, owning the bulk of the wealth of the United States, exercise their plutocratic power over the lives of the American people, who are forced, whether they will or no, to do the bidding of their wealth lords. And therefore, I say, capital is stolen labor, and its only function is to steal more labor. You ask me, what is the remedy? The remedy is clear and plain. The same remedy you apply when a man breaks into your strong box and takes your money. You capture him and take the stolen property away from him. It is the duty of the 65% of our population who produced all the wealth to reach over and take back the 60% of the wealth which the 2 million thieves have stolen from them and appropriated to the good of all, as all produced it, and therefore the mass of the people are entitled to it. Take over the railroads, take over the banks, and the issue of money and the public utility concerns, and take over the title of the lands that have no value except the value the community has given it, and then use all of this property for the general welfare of the community. This is not confiscation or robbery. It is simply taking from the thieves what they have stolen from you, and the first thing to take is to take control of the government out of their hands. Well, I mean, that sounds all fine and good, but generally what you find is that, and Pettigrew even said this, that, you know, has never really been a time, at least while he was in there, when a good-intentioned man lasted very long in Congress who wasn't bought off or forced out of the government. So I really don't know what he's hoping. You know, I guess he's just like, well, this time we're going to have good people who will take these jobs in the government and run everything right. I mean, I just can't see how he couldn't see that he's walking into a trap. Like, you know, the government and the businesses have always been one and the same practically since the start of the country. And so taking the property and the railroads and the banks and the money out of the hands of the businesses and giving it to the government, who is essentially the the lawyers and representatives of the business, as he has stated several times, like, how in the heck do you think that's going to make it better? You're taking it from them, taking it from the left hand and giving it to their right hand. And it just boggles my mind. But, you know, it all kind of predicates running on the idea that, you know, oh, we're going to get these, you know, godly, perfect people in here to run the government. And yet, all throughout history, you've kind of seen that it never happens. And he's even admitted it in this book, you know, so it drives me crazy. But, you know, at the time, I'm sure it seemed like, you know, like, oh my gosh, these people are, if we could just get it out of their hands, well, now we have more than enough history to know that, you know, you get somebody in there with good intentions and they're just going to get shunned in the back until they finally cave in and get bought off. And if they don't get bought off, they're going to have a miserable time and not be able to really do anything. I mean, you get in there, and what happens? You're a freshman. You don't get put on any committees. You don't get put on anything where you can even begin to make changes. You're pretty much relegated there until somebody sees that you can play ball with them, essentially. I mean, that's the way I put it. And I think, you know who articulates that very well is Dan Carlin. So I would tend to agree with his analysis on that whole situation. Not so much that you need to vote for third parties or whatever, but his analysis of voting in good government or something like that, I mean, it's pretty flawed if you really take a deep look at how the system works. And essentially, we've set it up, not we as in you and me, but But the system itself has kind of, and the owners of the system, as Pettigrew calls them, have set it up to where it's a perpetual motion machine. So they're playing all the angles, and obviously, you know, they're just waiting for people to fall right back into the trap. But anyways, that's the end of Chapter 9. Next time on the continued File and Claw audiobook archive presentation of Triumph and Plutocracy, we're going to look at Chapter 10. And the heading of this next chapter is Who Made the Constitution? And I can imagine he's going to have a few things to say about those often benevolent and godly painted founding fathers and this document that they created in secret and, you know, what his true purposes were. So stick around. Thanks for listening. I hope you pulled a few things out of that chapter. If nothing else, just another opportunity for me to hammer in the fact that, you know, turning to the government or turning to businesses to solve all the problems in the country is a trap. It's absolutely and always been a trap, so don't fall into it. But again, thank you for listening, and join us next time on the File and Claw Audiobook Archives for a continued reading of Triumph and Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, by Richard Franklin Pettigrew.
Before your eyes, there's no big surprise for you to realize. What to do now? It's been quite a year on our little blue sphere. Natural disasters, everybody's after. What to do now? A part of it.